Then indeed the great king Vaishravana, the great king Dhritarashtra, the great king Virudaka, and the great king Virupaksha, getting up from their seats, put their cloaks over one shoulder, placed their right knees on the ground, and making a reverential gesture with their hands towards the Lord, they spoke thus to the Lord. Lord, this excellent Suvarnabhasa, king of sutras, has been spoken by the Tathagata, watched over by all the Tathagatas, protected by them, and taken care of by the Bodhisattvas. When we merely hear this Dharma expounded by the Lord, through this nectar juice of the Dharma, the divine bodies of us four great kings, together with our armies and retinues, will wax with great might. In our body there will be produced prowess, strength and energy, brilliance, glory and splendour will enter our body. We, dear Lord, the four great kings, will live by the Dharma, will teach the Dharma, and rule by the Dharma. By the Dharma, dear Lord, we will exercise sovereignty over Nagas, Yakshas, Gandharvas, Asuras, Garudas, Kingaras and Maharagas. We will rout the hordes of Bhutas, who are pitiless, whose minds are without compassion, and we will watch over, guard and protect the whole of Jambudvipa. For this reason has the name Protectors of the World been given to us. So this is the beginning of chapter 6 of the Sutra of Golden Light. It's a long chapter. I think it might even be the longest chapter. And what happens in this chapter is that these four great kings, the four great kings of the four directions, who are also called the Lokapalas, the protector of the world, they come forward and they vow to protect the Sutra. And saying as well how much the Dharma, the nectar juice of the Dharma, nourishes them and makes their bodies and armies stronger and brighter and more brilliant. They make various vows, various promises to exercise their sovereignty according to the Dharma, to teach the Dharma, and especially to rule by the Dharma. They promise to protect the whole of Jambudvipa, the Rose Apple Island, which was the known world, if you like, according to ancient Indian cosmology and geography, which is rather different from our own. Let's just say they vowed to protect this world. And they promise later on to protect the monk who protects the sutra. By the monk who protects the sutra is presumably the monk who teaches the sutra, expounds the sutra, makes the sutra known, lives by the sutra. And the four great kings, the Lokapalas, promise to protect the kings who support the monks who protect the sutra. In ancient India, of course, monks, Buddhists, were reliant very heavily on patronage. Now, all this might well seem rather strange to you, rather foreign, and I hope the significance will become clearer as we go on. Bhante's lecture on this topic, the four great kings, it's called the Protectors of the Dharma, is masterful, it's brilliant, and it includes a succinct and brilliant survey of Indian Buddhist cosmology, and an equally brilliant discussion of the significance of the four great kings, the Lokapalas. And I'm not even going to try and precis all that. Just to say, it was interesting when we studied the Sutra of Golden Light with Bhante, when we were doing, many, many years ago, when we were doing our training as Mitra study leaders, he said a very interesting thing about when he was preparing the lecture on the protectors of the Dharma. He said he had a very, very strong sense of the presence of the four great kings, these very powerful presences. That was in, he was preparing those lectures, I think, in his room at Sakabati, which I think is now the centre office. Well, apparently the four great kings turned up there, so you're very well protected, those of you who work in that office. What we're concerned with here, of course, is the transition from transformation of self, which Richard Kato's dream and the verses on confession are particularly concerned with, even though it includes a vision of the transformation of the world, but they're particularly concerned with the transformation of the self. We're making the transition here from transformation of self to transformation of the world. And last night I noticed when we were reciting our liturgy, our puja from the Sutra of Golden Light, I was just very conscious of the tremendous aspirations that we're making, inspired by the sutra, that the sutra makes. We're vowing to follow the path in all its fullness. We're vowing to become Buddhas. We're vowing to teach the Dharma. And we're vowing to alleviate all of the suffering, all of the terrible woes of this world. And all those different woes are listed. I mean, obviously it's only just a portion of them, but you know, we're going through it, as we were going through it last night, I couldn't help but notice all this. Maybe it was in my mind, maybe I was picking up on somebody's thought transmission, I don't know. I had a little thought going through my mind, well, isn't this just a fantasy? Isn't this just a game? Isn't this something to just make us feel better about ourselves, making all these aspirations for the alleviation of the suffering of the world while the suffering goes on all around us? We say all these wonderful things, but what do we actually do? What do we actually do? What we do, if we do anything to alleviate the suffering around us, is so tiny, minuscule in relation to the suffering all around us. I mean, it's a grain of sand, you know, amongst, you know, billions of grains of sands in billions of Ganges rivers, to use a Mahayana image. There's so much suffering all around us, you know, wars, conflict, terrible damage being done to the environment, injustice, discrimination, torture, on and on and on it goes. This is just leaving aside sickness, old age, death, parting from those we love, all those things. There's just so very, very, very much suffering, utterly overwhelming. And I think there is something in, if you've been having those thoughts as we've been, you know, chanting these verses, I think there is something in it. I don't think you should sort of feel, am I just being cynical, thinking, well, you know, why are we doing all this? There's something in it. We have to take very great care as Buddhists not to get off, if you like, on our contemplation of the suffering of the world and our aspirations to relieve it all, but basically don't do anything about it. It's just a mental trip. We have to watch out for that. You know, when we leave the shrine room, when we leave the retreat, you know, we've had all those wonderful things going on in the shrine room, you know, perhaps the last stage of the Metta Bhavana, and all beings, I love you all, you know, and all that. We can be so enraptured by it all, enraptured by the Bodhisattva ideal and feelings of Metta, but we don't actually do anything about the actual reality of the people on our doorstep. Perhaps we don't even notice them. We're not even aware of them. I mean, there's that story that Sangharakshita tells of the wealthy Buddhist layman, the very rich Buddhist layman, who every morning in his personal shrine room, in front of his personal shrine, would assiduously do his metta bhavana. And always, just before the end of his metabhavna, so everything was just timed perfectly, his servant would come in and leave him his morning tea, so that when he came out of his metabhavna, there was a nice cup of tea waiting for him, ready to drink. And unfortunately, on this particular day, the servant tripped and made a racket and spilled the tea. And the layman jumped up, shouting at the servant, "You stupid oaf, you stupid fool, you're disturbing my metabhavna." I don't know if he gave him a beating as well, but... So maybe we're not as bad as that. I know for myself, I sometimes have to be very careful after a particularly good meditation, because I've noticed loads of times after good meditations, I can get into a strange conflict situation. It's really weird, almost like if Mara's kind of just waiting outside the door to sort of pounce on me. Very, very interesting that. If not that, if we're not as extreme as that, we might be someone who has all sorts of wonderful ideas about how to change the world. Wonderful programs to organise people about how they can change things. All sorts of suggestions and, you know, putting pressure on people to change this, to change that, to change the other, to be good people and be very busy with it, even that. And of course we get very annoyed when people don't conform to our ideas of the world and world transformation. And sometimes when you encounter people like that, you can think, well, are you interested in the transformation of the world, world transformation, or world domination? You start to wonder sometimes. I mean, it's all good stuff, but you suddenly realise that they're telling you what to do and they're not necessarily prepared to roll up their sleeves and get stuck in and doing it. I hear the weary comment from some centre chairmen and centre managers and people who are working really hard in their centre. And they're forever having to have conversations with people with all sorts of wonderful suggestions about how the centre should change and do this and do that. But the people suggesting it don't actually want to do anything. Don't want to actually do any work. Don't want to actually be involved. Full of ideas, full of suggestions, even annoyed when it doesn't turn out the way they want it, but then actually not prepared to take responsibility for the actual work of running the centre. It happens. So I think when we speak of transformation of the world, it's a short phrase, but it's a big phrase, isn't it? Let's begin on a very, very basic level indeed. Let's just start talking about, not just talking about, let's just start doing it. Let's start doing friendliness and helpfulness and kindness and consideration and generosity to the actual people, the actual living beings that we actually meet, that are actually in front of us, that we actually encounter day in and day out. If we can't do that, then there's really no point in talking about transformation of the world. It really starts on this basic human level. The people that we actually meet right now. Right now, the people next to you on retreat. This is where we should look, first of all, in this moment. Each one of us really caring for each other on this retreat. Real consideration, real care, helpfulness, kindness to one another. I mean, the way we've already heard it today, Arya Bandhu announced the photos, but is it Greg? Dan. Saying, hang on, I'm serving, what do I do? He didn't just think, oh well, I'll go and have my photo done and forget about the serving. So already there's a kind of that immediate awareness. I know this might sound very small, very human, and very ordinary, but that is the baseline. And I say it because I think sometimes some Buddhists can really forget about this basic human connection and human awareness and human helpfulness. So let's forget about, in a sense, what the world needs, and let's just start thinking about and seeing what the people around us actually need. at home with the people we live with, our family, our friends, our fellow community members, our neighbours, our work colleagues, the people that go to the centre, the people that we help run the centre with, the people taking the classes at the centre, the people you socialise with, you know, wherever it is. You start with the basic friendliness, consideration, helpfulness, generosity in that very, very straightforward way. That's where we have to begin. There's a wonderful field, a vast field of spiritual practice in all of those people that you encounter. And of course, we can also include other living beings, animals, and so on and so forth. I'm going to be concentrating mainly on people in this talk. Yes, kindness, consideration, helpfulness, certainly not hindering, not getting in people's way, not blocking them when they're living well, when they're growing well. Sangharakshita said somewhere, I think in one of his commentaries on the first precept, don't think of helping people, think of getting out of people's way. If you see somebody really growing and developing, well, just give them the space to really live, you know, to really develop. Very interesting way of looking at things. Don't block their energy, if you like. So yes, it can sound terribly obvious, but it can be missed, I think, by Buddhists. People, for example, can be so caught up with so-called insight, deep meditation experience. They can be so caught up with their practice of so-called mindfulness that they're just not aware of their environment, the world around them. Well, you know, if you're not aware of the world around you, there is no insight in that moment, and there's no mindfulness in that moment. You can be so concerned with the environment, environmental change, political change, and so on, but actually ignore the actual people around you, the living, breathing beings around you. You'll see it sometimes on our retreats. Washing up is quite an interesting time to observe people. I mean, I don't make a point of inspecting the washing up or anything like that, but you do sometimes see people in the washing up period who've know a bit about Buddhism, practicing a bit of Buddhism. It's usually when they're here on their first thing, and they you can see they're being mindful, going really, really slowly, really slowly. You know, they've read a book on mindfulness. Meanwhile, there's people working really hard around them to get the task finished in order to move on to the next event. So in a way, their mindfulness is very private, very personal, very partial. It's not broadened out to include the whole environment, the whole sense of the other people and the next event. It isn't what Chogyam Trungpa once called panoramic awareness, which is really what mindfulness is all about. It can happen in conversation. You know, we can be so obsessed with ourselves in conversation, we can just be completely unaware of the people we're talking to, going on and on and on about our own dramas, our own problems, and, you know, sort of enjoying the conversation while the other person is sort of shrinking into a state of complete emotional and psychophysical drainage. So awareness of others, real loving awareness of others, consideration for others. This is the absolute basis for the transformation of the world around us. So transformation of the world starts with basic metta. It starts, you could say, with treating others as human beings. Treating others as human beings. Living as a human being. Treating others as humans instead of as treating them as things. As sort of projections of our own mind. Of our own ideas, people on the edge of our consciousness. I personally feel there's a bit of a problem in Buddhism because of the emphasis on mind and consciousness. It's not a problem, I think, in Indian Buddhism, because I think people know what mind and consciousness really meant in that context. It's something extremely vivid, even perhaps a bit like our own word soul. The word chitta actually can be translated as soul, but we can't use the word soul because it's associated with something fixed and unchanging. But the word mind in the West is so much, you know, to do with thought, basically, and something rather cold and analytical and calculating and so on. And so I'm not very comfortable with the traditions that say that everything is mind. I don't think that's helpful for us. No, we need to see everything as human. Everything as human. Everything as a person. Even animals as people, things are people. We need to live in that kind of world, that kind of environment. We need to endow everything with what is most precious to us, which is our human beingness. Our human beingness. We need to really see that in the world around us and experience others as humans, living, breathing humans. And it's very easy, I think, to underestimate how powerful that is, to see others as human beings, to treat them as human beings. My friend Arloka, who has done all the work here, he was saying in a question and answer session, he said he thinks that we'll only really be successful as a Buddhist movement in the West when the word Buddhism and Buddhist disappears, when it vanishes. Because his take on things is that actually being a Buddhist is about being a human being in the fullest sense, whereas the notion of Buddhist conjures all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas which aren't really to do with that basic human beingness. I think he's onto something. And speaking like this, I am speaking with a particular inspiration. Not my own, from Dr. Ambedkar, Babasaheb Ambedkar, the great leader of the Dalit community, the downtrodden, the first law minister of the government of India, who framed the Indian constitution, which outlawed, of course, untouchability, that great hero, that great bodhisattva, who really led his people up out of the hell of untouchability, the slavery of untouchability. Dr. Ambedkar, who in the end, who saw the fulfillment of that as becoming a Buddhist, of going for refuge and going for refuge with hundreds of thousands of his followers, thus starting a whole Dharma revolution, and as Sangharakshita said, did more for Buddhism in the entire world since the Emperor Ashoka, which is quite something to say. Dr. Ambedkar, in his speeches and writings and communications, would often use a Marathi word to try and really get across to people a new vision of life, a new vision of one another. And that Marathi word is manuski. Manuski. Which is really impossible to translate in a way that, well, getting the full force of the translation. You can translate it as humanness. That would be, an acceptable coinage, humanness. But it doesn't really have the full power that it would have in Marathi. In Marathi, when people hear it, they get tingles all over them when they hear this word. Humanness, it's very, seeing every single person, seeing their manuski, primarily and first of all, their humanness. In other words, not seeing them as a Brahmin, or a Kshatriya, or a Vaishya, or a Shudra, that's the different castes, or an Aspruṣṭa, an untouchable, an outcast. Not seeing people in terms of caste, but seeing them as human. First and foremost, not seeing them in terms of their caste or their subcaste or the extended family they come from or the state they come from or the region of the state they come from, not seeing their nationality, not seeing that they're in terms of their job and their income, their position in government service or something like that, but first and foremost their humanness, not even seeing them in terms of their religion, whether they're Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, Jain, Parsi, whatever it might be, human. Human first of all, before anything else. Human essentially, human always. It's very, very powerful. Very, very powerful vision. Very, very powerful invocation from Dr. Ambedkar, because, and we don't really get it, because people do. They don't see the man or the woman. They don't see the individual. They see them, first of all, as belonging to a caste. It is so deep-rooted, this socio-religious institution of caste and everything that goes with it. You will hear sort of current Indian apologists saying, oh, it's not like that anymore, it's all changed. Don't believe a word. It's not true. It's as bad in some parts of India as it's ever been. This terrible way of seeing people that fixes them according to their birth. It's really, really awful. It's very interesting travelling with friends on a train in India, because we have these long train journeys. So travelling with Buddhist friends, you know, where you've got hours on a train journey and you're in the same compartment with other people. And of course, Indian people, by and large, are very, very friendly, very communicative, very sociable. But there's always this dance, and although I'm not at all fluent in Marathi and I don't know Hindi, I knew enough to know what was going on. So there'd be these polite inquiries about, what is your name? And my Buddhist friends, of course, would use their Buddhist name, Bodhisen. Oh, but what is your surname? Just Bodhisen. Dhammachari Bodhisen. Ah, but, it's always been Bodhisen. Yeah, Bodhisen. And where do you come from? What work do you do? And basically, they're trying to find out Bodhisen's caste. They're trying to place him in the hierarchy. They're trying to find out, in fact, whether they should be communicating with him. Whether it's okay according to the, you know, the caste duties. It's still there. It still goes on, maybe not as extreme as you know, Sangharakshita describes in his early memoirs, particularly in South India, but it's still there, this dance. In other words, it's not just about meeting as a human, it's about finding out who you can actually have social interaction with in the first place. Which, of course, is very, very divisive. Very, very divisive in a society, and very limiting and very frustrating. We might, of course, smile at this, but in our own ways we do it too. In our own ways we do it too. We have our own versions of it, sizing people up, labelling people. Is this somebody I can really talk to? You know, are they in my gang? Are they going to be somebody I like? We do it in all kinds of subtle and not so subtle ways. You know, is this an okay person to develop a friendship with? And there could be all sorts of extraneous, you know, issues which can go on, which prevent that. I'm not going to list them all. I think you just need to look at into your own mind to see if you do this. Anything to avoid the direct human encounter, free of all that labelling, the direct human encounter. And by human, of course, I don't mean simply biological designation. And by human, I'm not with the Buddhist notion of human. Dr. Ambedkar's notion of human is not in any way materialistic. For Dr. Ambedkar, a human being is essentially a growing and developing being. even before he became a Buddhist, it's quite clear in his writings that a human being has enormous potential to grow, for the humanity to develop. A human being, for Dr. Ambedkar, as for, of course, Buddhism, is not fixed in any way. There's a mind and a consciousness, a heart that can be developed and that can grow beyond itself, if you like. And of course, in Dr. Ambedkar, there's this, and in Buddhism, this strong sense of the ethical nature, the noble nature of the human that needs to be developed if we are to actually be true human beings. We need to experience ourselves as growing human beings, growing living beings, which of course for Dr. Ambedkar, the Hindu caste system did not allow for this, did not allow for the growth of the human individual, the human community. Great portions of society in India were repressed, were not allowed to be human. And of course, that's very damaging for also for the people doing the repressing as well, in that sense that they're also denying their humanity. Very dangerous for everybody. One of the things that Dr. Ambedkar said, some of his very, very strong speeches to, you know, to his people, you know, most of the time he's encouraging his people to get up and take responsibility for themselves, for their humanness, regardless of what was being done around them, to them. But he also had some very strong things to say to caste Hindus and to the whole kind of caste, people who would perpetuate the caste system. He would say, what you're doing is so dangerous. To repress great swathes of humanity, you are building up a powder keg. It will explode. If you deny somebody's humanity, if you deny a great swathe of a population their humanity, it will become destructive. And of course we see that all over the place. Where it's denied, people will, it won't just disappear, it will want to break out, it will want to smash the prison. And of course it's why, in the end, that Dr. Ambedkar chose the path to conversion, the path to Buddhism. Politics wasn't enough. Education wasn't enough. Trade unionism wasn't enough. Economics wasn't enough. Even changing the laws of the land was not enough. All of these things were tremendously important. But in the end, he believed that only a complete change of heart, change of consciousness, a revolution in consciousness, into a completely different culture, into a completely different religion, different tradition, a different atmosphere, would bring about lasting change within his community and in India as a whole. An atmosphere in which you can feel and experience and know your distinctive humanness, and you can relate to everybody else as human. That's why he converted to Buddhism in the end, because he felt that this is the tradition of humanity. This will lead to the real growth and development of the human, the distinctively human, and it will place no limit on that. In his great conversion speech, which is a tremendous speech and even more extraordinary in Marathi, the English translations don't do it justice. He talks a lot about energy and says how being treated as untouchable, being Hindus, had led to the disease of the whole community, to their whole kind of, you know, consciousness, and to a lack of energy because there's no, you know, prospect of real human growth. And he says, when you come into the Dharma, you begin to breathe in an atmosphere where you can experience the fruit of your efforts, where you can experience the fruit of the work you do. Buddhism, the Dharma, provides that atmosphere of freedom, of liberation. That's the Dharma. And it's very interesting speaking. I met people, I knew people, who In a way, they were the last, in a sense, of the generation that converted when Dr. Ambedkar was around, some of the early disciples of Sangharakshita of Bhante. And I asked them, I got them to tell me their stories of what it was like leaving Hinduism, becoming a Buddhist, what went on for them. And these great smiles that would come over their faces and laughter. And they'd say, freedom, liberation. So we were ecstatic. We'd taken our life into our own hands. And I said, well, what was it like? How were you treated by your neighbours, by the people in your community, the Hindus around you? And some of them said, oh, they treated us worse. You know, we couldn't buy things from the shop. The Hindu shopkeepers wouldn't sell anything to us because we'd gone out and become Buddhist. So there was no change. Actually, things got worse externally for them immediately. And I said, but how did you feel about that? We didn't care because we felt free. We'd gone for refuge to the Buddha. We'd thrown away the gods. We'd thrown away all the symbols of repression. We'd taken our life into our own hands. It's extraordinary, that sense of freedom, of liberation. And of course, on that basis, you got a lot of change. It wasn't just a change in them, as it were, in spiritually, psychologically. That tremendous confidence that came from the conversion to the Dharma led to all sorts of social, even sort of political impacts, particularly in Maharashtra state, where the Buddhist community is very, very strong, and in a sense, very upwardly mobile, I think we can say. Really amazing to see that, but it's rooted in the Dharma, and there's great interest from all over the Dalit community in India in the Dharma. People are beginning to see that Dr. Ambedkar's vision really was extraordinary, and they feel so let down by, you know, the traditions around them. If you really wanted to work for the Dharma endlessly without end, go and live in India and teach the Dharma. You'd never come to the end. Well, you won't come to the end here, but there's so many people who want to hear the Dharma, who need to hear the Dharma in India. And I must say that living in India, I lived in India probably on and off for about 6 years, it really gave me enormous confidence and faith in the Dharma, in the power of the Dharma to effect massive social change and revolution, Dhamma revolution. And it gave me great confidence that such a hard-headed, practical rationalist as Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar, and he really was like that, very, very hard-headed, practical man, that he saw that the Dhamma would underpin that great human revolution in India. That it begins with this deep change in consciousness. And you know, meeting people as well, people who are now in our order, quite a lot of people in our order, whose backgrounds are basically criminal. Violent, criminal, dangerous people involved in sort of revolutionary politics and, you know, modelling themselves on the Black Panthers and things like that, but basically sort of criminal, real Jack the Lads, if you like, serious people. Well, they were like that because they hadn't found the Dharma. And when they found the Dharma, they could put all that down. Like, you could really see that they had energy, very, very positive human energy that was frustrated by the lack of creative opportunity. When they found it, when we gave it to them, they were off. They were off into the Dharma. Some of our most outstanding order members in India, in the world, come to that, anywhere. Leading order members come from those kinds of backgrounds. You'd never think it on meeting them. So I use that expression, of borrowing from Dr. Ambedkar, atmosphere. When you breathe in an atmosphere, this very, very positive atmosphere of freedom. You could also say an environment. You need an environment in which you can experience your humanness. A supportive environment in which to experience that. And this takes us back, takes me back to the four great kings, our starting point, the Lokapalas, the protectors of the world. So let's have a look at them. They're really important in Buddhist tradition, Buddhist culture, Buddhist iconography. They're ubiquitous. They're all over the Buddhist world, every corner of the Buddhist world. They're not just Mahayana, you'll also find them in Theravadin countries. They're important in India, Tibet, China, Southeast Asia, Japan, Korea. Everywhere you go, you meet the four great kings, the four Lokapalas, and you especially find them in the vestibules of temples, of monasteries, guarding the entryway to the temple, to the monastery. That's where you'll find them, at the entrance to shrines and so on. At the centre, of course, of the main shrine, the temple, will be the Buddha or Avalokiteshvara or Padmasambhava or whoever it might be. But outside, on the threshold, are the four great kings. And they're really powerfully built. Really, really strong-looking characters. Quite scary to look at. Fierce and strong. They really are the protectors of the threshold. They stand at the threshold, at the entranceway to the shrine. So let's have a look at them. First of all, I want to situate them within Buddhist cosmology, and I'm going to simplify that. You're all aware, of course, of the Wheel of Life, of the six realms of existence. But that Wheel of Life is stratified into three planes. First of all, you have the Kama Loka, the realm of sense desire, which we're very familiar with. And in that realm are the hells, the pratas, the animals, the asuras, human beings, and lower gods. So within this, occupying a more refined sense realm are lower gods. Above the Kama Loka, there's the Rupa Loka, the realm of pure form, again inhabited by more refined gods who have a very pure form. And beyond the Rupa Loka is the Arupa Loka, another realm of gods. The gods are very subtle form. It's usually translated as formless, but it's more like very, very subtle. That's the sort of highest peak of the mundane. All of these, this stratification, this is all the mundane. This is all the world. From the hells, through us, up to the highest and most refined God realm. That is conditioned existence. Beyond or outside of all that is the Lokottara, the transcendental, the realm of the Buddhas. They also, these three planes of existence, correspond to different states of consciousness. If you want to find them, you can find them in your consciousness. We have the potentiality for all of these states. And you know what that's like, don't you? If you're in a state of intense, unsatisfiable craving, well, you're a hungry ghost in that moment. And you're operating in a very, very shadowy realm. You might look to everybody else like a human being, but you don't feel like that. You feel like something else. Sometimes our experience of consciousness can be really hellish, and the world can look hellish too. Sometimes it can be really godlike, as when we're in dhyana states or transported by great art. The world looks very different. Looks like a kind of heaven. It's not the same world anymore. So you can have, I think, a bit of a feeling for what it's like to inhabit these different realms. But as I say, they're all mundane. What's interesting about them, of course, is that they're a hierarchy, a positive hierarchy. They're each of these realms are higher than the other. The gods are higher than us. They are greater than us because they occupy more skillful, more refined states of consciousness. That word hierarchy, well, as soon as you say it, people start freaking out, they feel very nervous. shouldn't it all be democratic and all the rest of it? Well, sorry, guys, the Buddhist vision of existence is hierarchical. There's a movement between ourselves and enlightenment. It's a very positive, natural hierarchy. And this is really important, this notion of hierarchy. We don't have to see hierarchy in terms of power and oppression, which is the way we've been taught to see it. The whole idea of hierarchy is that you don't have to go straight to enlightenment. That's a big leap. That's too much to go from here to the fullness of wisdom and compassion. There are steps. There are stages in consciousness, in being. What a relief that we can do that, that there is a next step that we can take. On one occasion, Sangharakshita kind of gave us a kind of hierarchy of different beings that we can move through. We move from the human to the artist, in the sense of whether or not we're making art, to being creative with our states of mind. The artist opens out into the god or the angel, and then on to the bodhisattva and on into the Buddha. I find that a very inspiring prospect. We're not just left at this level. There's not just us and enlightenment. There's a whole sequence of stages and steps that we can take. So as a human being, we have all this richness and possibility available to us. We're not in a flat, materialistic landscape. We have all this richness and possibility available to us. Now, the four great kings, the four protectors of the world, are gods. And they occupy the lowest of the heavens of sense desire. So they're just above us. They're very close to us, the four great kings. Just beyond us. Apparently they live on the summit of Mount Meru, the central mountain, but we don't go into all that. But these four great kings are said to guard the four directions. And they watch over the various weird and strange and wonderful non-human beings that occupy these different directions. So they've got particular jurisdiction over different beings, over the crude and chaotic forces that actually have a very powerful influence upon us, but which we're largely unconscious of. So let's have a look at the four great kings and who they're the kings of. First of all, there's Dhritarashtra. He's white in colour. He guards the eastern direction. His name means upholder of the land. He keeps an eye. He rules over the Gandharvas, the celestial musicians who live on perfumes. He also keeps an eye on the Pisachas, the vampires, the blood drinkers, which seem to be so popular these days, if popular culture is anything to go by. He makes sure that we're not taken over by the vampires. There's Virudaka, whose name means growth, who's yellow in colour. He looks over the southern direction. He keeps an eye on the praetors, the hungry ghosts. He makes sure the praetors don't go out of hand, as well as the Kumbhandas. Kumbhandas means those whose testicles have the shape of a giant water jug. I don't know what the Kumbhandas are particularly, I don't know what they're particularly concerned with, but perhaps you can imagine. Maybe they're the sort of cosmic studs, I don't know, but anyway. Virudaka keeps a close eye on the Kumbhanda demons. Virupaksha, whose name means him of the bulging eyes, or the wrathful eyes, is red. He watches over the western quarter. He keeps an eye on the Nagas, the dragons, the water spirits, who can appear and disappear, make themselves very big, very small, who are very greedy and sit on treasure, like Smaug in The Hobbit. He also keeps an eye on the Putanas, the fever spirits. Make sure the fever spirits don't get out of hand, giving everybody fevers. And then there's Vaishravana, whose name means greatly learned, who's green, who occupies the northern quarter. Vaishravana keeps an eye on the yakshas, the powerful nature spirits, the sort of daimons of the land, as well as the rakshasas, the flesh eaters. He makes sure that they don't do mischief. So the four great kings are powerful gods who rule over all of this, and other forces as well. Apparently there's all sorts of other forces that they keep an eye on. Forces that can really wreak havoc if they are not ruled, and not ruled according to the Dharma. Now this might all seem very strange, very foreign, very Eastern, very quaint. But it's interesting, Mr. Chen, Yogi Chen, Bhante's teacher, Mr. Chen, when he moved to California, I think he lived in San Francisco, he was talking to a Western disciple of his one day. He was saying, well, there aren't any demons in the West, are there, Mr. Chen? And Mr. Chen said, you're joking. There's demons everywhere. When I walk down the street in San Francisco, I can see demons crawling all over the cars, clambering up the sides of buildings. They are absolutely everywhere. And of course, we human beings tend to think that we are in complete control, that we're the master of all that we survey. But so often we have really no idea what forces we are invoking, or even what forces might be playing us. I mean, it's very obvious when you look at war. There's so much in the news, you know, the different wars that have been fought lately, those poor, terribly devastated countries of the Middle East. I know these issues are terribly complicated, but it's so obvious that war unlocks terrible forces, forces that people have absolutely no control of and don't know what to do about. And you realise when you see these sort of things, you realise how fragile the human, the attainment of the human really is. It's almost as if these forces, these chaotic forces, these demons of pestilence and war and all the rest of it, are just waiting to explode. I remember when I was in India going to a city called Jalna to give a Dharma talk, a lot of Buddhists in Jalna. But Jalna, the city in Maharashtra, is famous for its Hindu-Muslim strife. There have been terrible Hindu-Muslim riots, a lot of people killed on both sides, a lot of violence. And I was travelling in a rickshaw, sitting in the back of one of those auto rickshaws with two order members in between them on the back seat. I'd arrived there by bus from Bombay. And we were going through the bazaar area, the centre of Jalna, and the rickshaw driver, who was a Muslim, I could tell he was a Muslim because of the, you know, the calligraphy in his rickshaw, swerved to avoid somebody on a moped, and suddenly the rickshaw was surrounded by Hindus. Suddenly, it was surrounded, and I looked out at these people, and the crowd was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And they weren't human beings anymore. This was a malevolent pack. It wasn't human beings. It was quite obvious. I've never seen the demonic, but here it was. This was the demonic. There wasn't an ounce of humanity in that moment, in those people. It was a raging demonic force, rocking the rickshaw, slapping the rickshaw driver, pulling him out, punching him, beating him up. It was a really horrible, frightening situation. And I said to the order members, I think we need to do something. And they just, I think they've been here before. They just put their hands on me and kept very, very, very still. It was an explosive situation. And the rickshaw driver was pushed back into the rickshaw with the words, you're very lucky that there's a special visitor to this town today and he's in your rickshaw. And off we went to where we were staying. He got away with it. It was really, really frightening moment. And I like to think that perhaps in that moment, one of the Lokapalas had turned up to deal with the demonic force. But it's really like that. It just showed me that how fragile humanity is. You know, presumably these people, you know, were feeling this because of all the violence of the past, but they weren't seeing this poor rickshaw driver as a human being in that moment. Very frightening. So we're not that far away, I think, from these very, very powerful forces. In the sutra, the Lokapalas, the four great kings, place themselves at the service of the Buddha, of the golden light. It seems that they need something, someone, themselves, to look up to revere, to respect, someone, something greater that will give their work of guarding the world real meaning and purpose. Through that, they themselves can be benefited. Through that, their work can be more meaningful. It can be for the Dharma. They say that the Dharma for them, the golden light for them, is like nectar juice that makes their bodies and armies wax with great might. It makes their divine bodies glow even more splendidly. Sangharakshita says body here doesn't just mean the physical body, it's their whole being. Their whole being is enriched and strengthened and made more beautiful, more glorious, more sublime by the Dharma. Their life is given real purpose by the Dharma, by the golden light of the Dharma. Because it's the golden light that underlies, that supports, that guarantees all human growth and development, that safeguards the human, that protects the human from these forces. If we want to guarantee the human, if we want to guarantee our own humanity, if we want our own humanity to be irreversible, well, we're going to have to open up to something greater. If we want the human in us not to be overrun by the forces of chaos, by the demonic, we have to become stream entrants. We have to become irreversible from enlightenment. The golden light has to take us over completely. So to guarantee the transformation of the world, we need to found that on the deepest possible level, on the golden light of the Dharma. It's so easy to fall back from the attainment of humanity. So, yes, I said earlier, the four great kings are outside of the temples and monasteries. They're the protectors of these places. They don't allow the negative, disruptive forces to come into these places. But what are these places? What are temples? What are monasteries? They are environments in which we can be fully human, where we have the space and freedom to develop our humanity fully. They are the spaces in which we can make our humanity irreversible. They are protected spaces in that sense. They're protected from that which is not human, that would destroy the human, these chaotic forces. So we need these environments. We need our temples and our monasteries. We need our modern versions of them, our centres, our wonderful urban centres on the high streets, you know, right in the cities. What wonderful places they are. Wonderful places, environments where you can get away from the chaos, the non-human, if you like. Our communities, and, well, up until recently, our team-based Right Livelihoods. There's still a few left, but sadly we lost Windhorse Trading, which, you know, was catastrophic, really. Yes, it's not the end of the world, but what a wonderful environment that place was and a working environment to develop the human. We need our retreat centres, we need our outreach groups. These are all places where we can come together to be fully human, to feel free to grow, to transform, and yes, to go back out into our particular portion of the world, stronger with the Dharma, so that we can really bring about change and transformation around us. Don't underestimate these environments. They're very special and very, very precious indeed, and easily destroyed. You know, wind horse trading wasn't in existence for very long, actually. So easily destroyed by the forces of the world. It'd be very, very easy to destroy a place like Padmaloka if people really wanted to. It'd be very, very easy to do that. Very, very easy to lose centres. It has happened. They take a lot of effort to create these environments, to maintain these environments. It's very interesting. A lot of people are very keen on Padmasambhava because he converts the demons to the Dharma. And everybody loves all that. You know, they love, you know, going to put a building, beating their drums and invoking Padmasambhava. And that's great. That's good. Lovely thing to do. I'm not knocking it. But why? Why was he called? Why was he called to Tibet? Because they were trying to build a monastery. They were creating an institution, a temple, a mandala, a home, if you like, for the spiritual community, an environment where people could come together to practice the Dharma. It was that building that was upsetting the demonic forces. And Padmasambhava had to enlist their help, enlist their power to build and create the monastery, the space, the environment in which people were free to practice, to learn, to hear the Dharma. The Buddha, Padmasambhava, didn't convert the demons just for the fun of it, just because he did it. It was for a purpose. It was to establish the environments in which the Dharma could be practiced. Of course, you know, buildings are not enough. Buildings are tremendously important, but it's the people within them that really create the environment. You know, if we didn't have a really good community at Padmaloka, you know, really practicing the Dharma and really making you welcome when you come here to practice the Dharma, you wouldn't experience this as a place in which you could grow and develop in the Dharma. It would just be, you know, a building. I remember when we were in India, when we started things, and we had to teach the Dharma wherever we could find it. We didn't have, you know, any places where we could teach, no big buildings or anything like that. You know, we'd take classes, you know, on, you know, almost squatting in disused buildings, you know, by the side of the road, and, you know, somebody's garage when the car was out. You know, it was a Catholic house, I think. No, it wasn't. They were Protestants. They went to church every Sunday, so they let us use their garage where they kept the car, where we could do classes. We had to use all these sort of places. And, of course, people, a lot of the wider Buddhist community, big players in the Buddhist community in India at that time, were sort of think, well, they weren't that impressed because, you know, we just did it where we could, teaching the Dharma. And remember Sangharakshita saying that why we haven't built a big centre or a big vihara. And he said, well, what we're concerned at the moment is we're concerned with creating a community. We're concerned with people practicing the Dharma. It's no good building a hospital if you've got no doctors and no nurses to run the hospital. So yes, you start with the people. And of course, it's out of the people that we've created these places. We've created these environments in which we're free to practice. And we need to do everything that we can to keep them alive. One of the points that Sangharakshita makes in his lectures is that the Lokapalas, they protect the threshold. They keep out what is hostile, inimical to the Dharma. They also allow in. They allow in. And that means that they will sometimes allow in, well, they do allow in the chaotic, powerful energy in itself, because that's who we are. We are that powerful, chaotic energy. All that needs to be brought in to enrich the Dharma. All this energy that we have needs to come in and to be transformed by the Dharma to enrich the Dharma. That's part of the great symbolism of the Lokapalas. So it's very interesting, back in the early days, how much Sangharaksha, as well as encouraging us to study and to meditate and to do prostrations and to go on retreat, he was really encouraging us to work. And he was giving these lectures when we were working on that conversion of that old fire station into a really fantastic Buddhist centre. And that meant really hard physical work. Knocking down walls, plastering, bricklaying, climbing up scaffolds. I mean, at the time, I think some of us wondered, well, what is this? But it was exactly what we needed. Young men with lots of energy. We needed that gross physical work so that we could transform that and put it at the service of the Dharma. But also other things, ambition. You know, some of our leading order members, tremendously ambitious people, and I'm not necessarily using the word ambitious in a negative sense. Lokamitra, extraordinary ambition and vision. You know, how do you, you know, the way he worked in India, all of his sort of hustling energy, you know, was taken up and incorporated into the work of spreading the Dharma. That's what he was like, really making things happen. Tremendous sort of Lokapala energy at work and in play. We need that. So as Buddhists, don't be frightened of those strong energies in your work and practice. Take them up into the Dharma. Use them to develop the Dharma. Use them to protect and develop these environments in which we can experience ourselves as human beings, where we can grow as human beings, where as human beings we can open up fully to the golden light of the Dharma, so that, yes, so that our humanity will be irreversible, irreversibly moving on to Buddhahood itself, and so that we can do all that we can to bring that Dharma to, yes, in the end, all living beings, and thus bring about the transformation of life and world.